Call to order. It is 3:20 on February 9th, and staff are Linda Miller, my health aide, Kelly Burnett is our House Recording Secretary, Dawn Finley Groves is our LIO moderator. And those present are
rearranging the furniture.
Are Anderson, Gardner, Cisna, and myself, Wilson. And so we are not going to hesitate at all because we're running late and we've got a lot to cover today. And we're going to hear House Bill 408 today. We're also going to have a presentation by the National Council of Alcohol and Drug Dependents. And but the first thing before that, we are going to have confirmation of the governor's appointees. So, and they are online. So let's see, I think I'll go to, is Bonnie Gaborik online? And these are our appointments, the governor's appointments to the Professional Teaching Practices Commission. And just to join us is Representative Gatto. So now we definitely have a quorum. So, Bonnie, are you online?
Yes, I am.
You know what I'd like you to do first is tell us a little bit about why you are interested on being on the Professional Teaching Practices Commission and any comments that you might have. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I've been in Alaska this last time since 1977. And I've been teaching at Salch Elementary in the Fairbanks District since 1980, where I've been a classroom teacher, head teacher, principal, teach. Now I'm a teaching principal. And I was appointed last year to fill a vacant spot on the commission. And now I'm asking to be confirmed to fill my own position on the commission. I felt it was a very challenging group to be with, a high-caliber group of people. I think the work that we do, for lack of a better term, policing our own ranks, is really important. And I think it's really important that we maintain the ethics of our profession and safeguard the well-being of our children. And I would just like the chance to fill a full term.
All right. Thank you, Bonnie. Are there any questions from the committee?
We just have a moment here since I'm such a late arrival.
Right. They're looking over your resume, Bonnie.
Oh.
Bonnie, what do you, this is Representative Gatto.
Yes.
What do you see as an issue that might come before you? For instance, do you see that we have a teacher who has been severely reprimanded and they've come before the commission? Is that how you see the work you're doing?
You know, since I've been on the commission, we haven't had quite that scenario. We did have a situation where a teacher was struggling understanding the difference of maintaining their own private personal religious views from what should be expressed publicly in a school. And we went through quite a lengthy two-day hearing on this. We ended up giving the teacher the benefit of the doubt, but a very strict warning that he could not continue to, you know, to press his own views, that he had to keep them to himself and learn to keep public and private views separate. That's the most serious one I have sat in on. There have been more serious ones along the way. And then we just met a couple of weeks ago, and the bulk of the cases that came through the executive director's office had to do with school districts who are forced to hire teachers who are not certified or to have, for whatever reason, didn't have their certification because there's such a crunch for teachers. And we didn't hear of those cases. A lot of them were solved, but that seemed to be a large part of what we're dealing with these days, is making sure everybody is properly certified and in their fields they should be teaching in.
Follow-up, Representative Adam.
Yeah, okay, thanks, and I have one more question. If a teacher was guilty of DUI off duty, let's say the previous Friday night, so, you know, sober at the time, Do you feel that that's a teacher that maybe, and the question came before you, how would you respond to handling of the issue of whether or not that teacher is qualified to be in the classroom?
Well, the teacher, if I think you'd have to take it a case-by-case scenario. The teacher probably is qualified to be in the classroom, but if it's a repeated offender, you certainly would not want to ignore that. That's a tough one to answer without specifics.
Yeah, that really is. And so it is, and I'm sure you were right on when you said it depends on the circumstances and maybe the school regulations and things like that. I don't know, the board regulations.
And I think each district has it set up how they handle them, but you certainly want to be watching for a repeated pattern by all means. And then you'd have to cooperate with what the district does and what the legal authorities are doing at the time. I guess the bottom line is you don't ever want a teacher to be in a situation where they are willfully harming their students.
Right. Okay, thank you, Bonnie. And Representative Gardner?
Yeah, I just have a quick question. First of all, thank you for your willingness to serve in this way. Since you're one of the candidates who has some experience on this particular board already, or rather commission, do you have any ideas about how the functioning of the commission might be improved? Do you see any weaknesses or areas that you might make an unusual contribution to?
Well, actually, I don't at this time. I'm very impressed with the job that Bonnie Barber has done, and I'm also quite impressed with the caliber of people who are on the commission and the seriousness which they take their jobs. I mean, we are not playing around. We are working hard from the time we're there in the morning until we fly out, whatever night we fly out. But right now, no, I don't have any suggestions to make any major changes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Seeing no other questions, I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair. I move that recommend. Let's see if Sharon can remember what.
Maybe she'll tell us.
The motion I'd like to have is actually that the Health and Education Social Service Committee has reviewed.
Want me to give it?
She's got it now.
Excuse me. Yes, I do need coaching on occasion. I'm looking at something that says something quite different than that. I move that the Health, Education, and Social Services Committee has reviewed the qualifications for Bonnie Gaborik and the governor's appointment to the Professional Teaching Practices Commission and to recommend that her name be forwarded to the Joint Commission for consideration.
Okay. Hearing no objection, so moved. Congratulations, Bonnie, and we will forward this now, there will be the vote on the joint session of the legislature, and I don't know for sure on that date, but I'm sure somebody will let you know. So
thank you very much.
And next we'll have Linda Black. Are you online, Linda?
Yes, I am.
Hey, go right ahead, Linda. Tell us a little bit about yourself and why you would like to serve.
All right, I'd be happy to. I was born in Fairbanks, Alaska, so Alaska is in my heart. I spent the last three decades of my life working in the Alaskan public schools, mostly in the Anchorage School District, although I did work in Alaska state-operated schools back in the 70s. Now I'm in higher education, and our academic dean nominated me for this position. The reason I'm very interested in serving is that I think we as educators need to hold ourselves to the highest ethical standards and serve as models to our students and to our communities because we serve in that special position of trust. And I think that we, looking from within, have a special vision of how things could and should be working. And so I want to continue to improve education in Alaska.
Okay, thank you, Bonnie. Looking at your list of honors and community contributions. It's a long list, and you've even been the Alaska Elementary Principal of the Year, so what an honor. That's wonderful. So I'm sure you're well qualified. Representative Gatto has a question for you.
Yeah, Linda, I also was working for SOS in the 70s, so I'm just curious. I worked at Eielson. Where did you work?
I worked out of the central office and then traveled to the rural Alaskas. First, I was in the children's cache where we started preschool programs, and then I worked in various of the Title I programs doing the teacher training and aid training.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Cisna?
Yes, and Madam Chair, I guess I'd like to say it kind of a recommendation for this candidate because Dr. Black was the principal of one of my district schools.
Oh.
And I've spent a number of hours speaking with her about the school system and saw that she did a superb job in the school that she was principal of, so I know that she would do a good job on this.
Okay.
Oh, thank you so much.
Do I hear a motion?
If I practice, Madam Chair, I might get good at this. I move that the Health, Education, and Social Services Committee has reviewed the qualifications for Linda Gillum Black for the governor's appointee to the Professional Teaching Practices Commission, and I recommend that her name be forwarded to a joint session for consideration.
Okay, hearing no objections, this is now on its way. And thank you very much, Linda, and congratulations.
And thank you all very much.
Okay, and that leaves one more, Craig Baker in Kodiak. Are you there, Craig?
I am.
Go right ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself and why you're interested in this position.
For me, this is a reappointment. I've been on the commission already for 3 years, and it's an honor to be a part of the commission. I've been on a number of commissions and boards and the like, and it's the most interesting, fascinating commission I've ever been on, and I truly look forward to it every time I have an opportunity to go. The variety of cases that we see is, it's just interesting, I really enjoy it.
All righty, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I'm sort of curious, over 3 years, have you seen any changes, different themes that the council is addressing or the commission's addressing?
I don't believe I've seen any real changes in the commission itself and the way it operates, if that's what you're asking, Representative Gardner, but I'm constantly seeing new things. Again, teachers are people. And they make all kinds of mistakes, and it's interesting the things that come before us. Oftentimes, you just never know what it is we might see, and we don't actually know until we get there.
I think what Bonnie, I'm are the issues that the matters that are coming before you. Do they have certain themes, and do those change over time, or in 3 years has there not been anything that's different?
No, there hasn't been anything different. I think it's pretty much the same. I've seen. Statistics about the types of cases that the commission has seen in its existence, and it's the same. Again, we're seeing more and more in regards to whether a teacher is properly, the licensure issues. That's more and more of an issue. We see that all the time. In the rural sites, we're seeing typically this time of year, actually it's at Christmas, teachers that don't come back, and that's, of course, an issue. They have to fulfill their contract and can't leave kids out there. But not really. It's pretty much the same things over and over again.
Thank you.
So you're, Craig, so you're saying that especially probably new teachers, and they experience that first 3 months, and it's pretty scary, and when they go for Easter or Christmas vacation, sometimes they don't come back?
Yeah, exactly. You know, they're teaching in rural districts up north somewhere, and I don't think they're fully ready for what they step into oftentimes.
Do you know anything about the mentoring program that they have now?
I am familiar. Well, we had a mentoring program here in Kodiak for years. I know there's a statewide mentoring program that's I actually have some literature on my desk, which I was thinking about actually contacting them to see if I could get some help. I'm teaching a zoology class this year, a brand new class, and I thought that would be a nice thing. I know that it's in existence.
It would be interesting over the next couple of years, since that we've had the mentoring program in place last year, I think for the first time, if there's not as much of that Christmas desertion. So hopefully that program will help in that area. Anyway.
Yeah, I imagine it would. It would be nice to have some help.
Yeah. Any other questions from the committee? Do I hear a motion?
I think Rep. Sisna can probably do it perfectly.
Representative Sisna. Yeah.
Well, three times the charm. I move that the Health, Education, and Social Services Committee has reviewed the qualifications for Craig Baker, the governor's appointee to the Professional Teaching Practices Commission, and to recommend that his name be forwarded to a joint session for consideration.
Okay, hearing no objection. So we are excited about this, and all of these three persons appointments have now are going to be passed on to the joint committee. So thank you very much for the three of you for taking time out to talk to us, and congratulations.
Thank you.
Okay. That brings us now to House Bill 408, Definition of Child Abuse and Neglect, and we're still on version A. And I pulled this last week because of the fact that we kind of talked about it in the committee and kind of agreed that we needed to make sure that it wasn't just drugs, but drugs and alcohol that was included in the definition. And so I think we all each have a copy of that. And do we all have a copy? And does the department want to come up and kind of say we worked with the department, Representative Gardner and I, and Representative Sisna had some thoughts on it too. And so we worked together with the department, and we came up with this definition. So why don't you let us know how you guys feel about it. State your names so that everyone knows who you are.
For the record, my name is Duane Gibbons with the Office of Children's Services.
I got it.
And I'm Stacy Crayley with the Department of Law.
And Madam Chair, yes, I would like to say that the department is in support of the proposed amendment. We think that it addresses the issues mentioned in the committee on this past Tuesday. It reflects current practice in terms of reports that the Office of Children's Services receives. So we think it's a good amendment, and we support it.
Now, I want to make sure everyone on the committee realizes that the only thing we changed at all, we changed the wording a little bit, but that kind of cleaned it up a little bit and tightened it up a little bit. But the only thing that got changed is that it talked about a controlled substance, and we've added or alcohol. And that does not change anything in current practice. All providers out there are already required, if they come across something like this, to report it. So there's no change in the way the public are treated or anything because of this. So, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the department. So, at first blush, I read this and I support it. But in talking with my staff earlier today, and I don't want to be duplicative if you've talked about this already in the committee, which I missed last meeting. Let's take the hypothetical, which we so often hear, where you have a mother who didn't know she was pregnant and is in normal social circles and has drank at this event, that event, whatever, and then finds out she's pregnant, quits drinking, and child is born and has fetal alcohol syndrome. I don't know the delineation or levels upon which that can occur. I know as a father-to-be, in another month, I can go to the lecture from midwifery associations here who say, my God, you have one sip and you're doomed. You can go to Europe who says have a glass of wine a day and your Tylenol because it's good and it reduces pain. Then you can go to the American Medical Association. I mean, I've read ad nauseum things left and right. My wife doesn't drink, but that concerned me a little because the doctor, when we went in and had ultrasound, we joked and said, what about all those women you know, high school girls get pregnant, college girls, married or not, and what if they were drinking and didn't know they were pregnant and then found out? And then the termination would be, hey, there's an effect of a controlled substance. It looks like there's a problem with the child, and the child has FAS. And, of course, the mother says, God, I didn't know. I mean, I didn't drink while I was pregnant when I knew I was pregnant.
Through the chair, Representative Anderson, well, I'm not an expert on fetal alcohol syndrome, and there would be other folks that are, but that particular issue is not something that can be diagnosed immediately upon delivery, is my understanding. And but in any case that we would get called at time of delivery if there's concern by a healthcare provider, we would do an assessment, and it's not a case by case basis. If a healthcare provider is concerned, we would be there. We would talk to them. We would talk to the mom. We would look at the circumstances. And I'm sure that our workers out in the field see, you know, every spectrum, you know, every possible case along the spectrum in those kinds of things. So it doesn't mean that, you know, we're going to walk in and take custody of your baby and,
sure,
you know, there's all these things. So we would do an assessment.
Okay, and then just to follow up.
Well, just a minute, because okay. I'd like to bring you up to par where we're at with this bill. Because,
and I saw the change. I don't know if that fixes my issue, though.
No, but this bill does not change anything at all in this state right now. These changes are only to come so that the feds can look at what Alaska's doing and checking a box saying, so it kind of is conforming to the federal language. And so we just added that, but it changed nothing in practice across the state. And that's important for you to realize.
Okay.
So nothing is being changed as far as what we do in this state.
But, I mean, there's a reason for the bill, though. You mean, and the reason is to redefine child so that it fits. I don't understand. You mean so that the federal government looks?
Yes, so that we're in line with the federal guidelines, and we're also just changing it so that we're putting in statute what we already do.
And what, through the chair, meaning if it appears that there's fetal alcohol problems with a child, you could foresee at times a physician or the practitioner calling, I guess, the...
Right now.
Yeah, right now calling the Division of Child Services or one of those entities saying, hey, there's a problem. It looks like this mother's been drinking a lot, and we're worried about her parenting ability with the child.
Through the chair, Representative Anderson, yes. And that currently happens now. And we do respond to those calls.
Okay.
And if I might just clarify.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Representative Anderson, just because there's a report of harm doesn't mean the child's removed. I mean, there are a lot of things that can happen short of removing the child from the parent's custody. There
sure.
can be no action taken. There can be supportive services at home. They can say the baby can go home as long as dad is in the house, or lots of other things. The whole idea is simply to assure the safety of the child. And sometimes nothing is necessary.
Okay.
Any other questions? Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a very simple amendment that corrects language here. In page 1, line 1, the word and disagrees with everything below it, and I believe the word and should read or, so that it conforms with line 5, 2, which says child abuse or neglect. And I believe that was probably the intent, and probably the drafter slipped.
Hang on a second here.
I was concerned child abuse and neglect would require both be present simultaneously.
not necessarily, because it's defining them.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, if I may, the statute that's amending, and thank you for Representative Gatto catching the inconsistency, but the statute that we're amending, 4717290, subparagraph 2, is child abuse or neglect. So the or needs to be changed in line 1, and it reads correctly in line 5.
Okay. So
correct.
Okay. So the title needs to be changed.
The end needs to be corrected in line 1 rather than... Okay.
That's okay. Correct.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay, dope. That would be amendment number 1, and you want to go ahead and
yep. Madam Chair, I move amendment number 1, and that is to delete the word and in page 1, line 1, and substitute the word or.
All right. Hearing no objection, so moved. So, and then we have another amendment. Representative Gardner?
Yes, I'd like to offer amendment number 2, and when this bill was initially presented, we discussed the fact that in page 1, line 9, the language or the structure of the bill initially was a complex way of defining child. And what we really needed to do is define the abuse statute. And so the sponsors redrafted kind of the definition, and that's basically what the amendment is. In addition, we added alcohol, as we've discussed previously, to controlled substances. And I do want to point out that when we talk about child abuse, we talk about exposure, damage, or adversely affected. We talk about exposure, withdrawal, and adverse effects. And we've carefully crafted this that the fact that a child has been exposed isn't necessarily enough to trigger a report of harm. What we're looking for is any indication the child may have been adversely affected or is experiencing withdrawal symptoms, so withdrawing from exposure to it.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks. I appreciate your response and the department's response to my question, and I appreciate the articulation of the amendment. But I would state that I don't think you reconcile by that definition, as Representative Gardner just said, my concern. And I don't think if there's an adverse effect by alcohol, the point is you can call the division if there's an adverse effect by alcohol. So if the baby's born and there's an adverse effect, you think it's fetal alcohol syndrome, then you can call the department and say, hey, I want an investigation. It looks like this mother's been drinking while she had the baby. So that doesn't reconcile my point that someone could find out they're pregnant 8 weeks in and say, I had a normal lifestyle of drinking and my kid has fetal alcohol syndrome, and someone could say, hey, that adversely affected the baby, so I'm going to call the department on you. I mean, how does that not...
Well, they do call the department, through the chair, Representative Anderson. If the department's called, again, it doesn't mean the child's removed. If the investigation reveals that a woman who had no idea she was pregnant quit drinking and there are problems with the child and the mother is apparently sober and there are no indications that the child is going to be abused or uncared for, then there would be no grounds for removal.
That makes
sense. It's just the same as if a child is injured when it's in your care. If you haven't been negligent or uncaring, that's not necessarily grounds to remove the child. The investigating neighbor may say this child has a black eye and the parent's not watching, and the parent says, you know, can demonstrate that they were, that kids do have accidents. It's not an indication of abuse always. So
that makes sense. But that would also, to that end, it would also... You could extrapolate that out to say that if there is an injury in the child, then there should be an investigation to see if the parent did that, and that could be a domino effect. I see the point of the bill, and I won't certainly prevent it from moving on. But it was just a judicial aspect of it, and being in judiciary with Representative McGuire and the others, we go through assiduously bills like this, and Representative Guerra and Gruenberg have trained me well to say, now wait a minute, what if this were to happen? It sounds like you're saying, and for the record, we can assure that the odds of that happening are not there. I'm not really worried about it, but it came to my attention in the office earlier, and I think it's fair to put on the record. But again, I think it would be hard to prove, like you say, fetal alcohol syndrome doesn't come from that. It comes from, I think, significant abuse. From what I've read. Thank you.
Representative Sisna?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And really, to the point that Representative Anderson is speaking, I voiced some concerns in our last committee about this issue, that I'm concerned that that the mother and her child have already fallen off of the cliff, and we're dealing with them while they're part way down or when they've gotten to the bottom of the cliff, and we're not doing prevention. And that's what we keep doing. And we spoke earlier, Madam Chair, about the need of this committee to really be working on proactive, preventative measures. And we talked about a potential bill from the committee that would, in fact, address Representative Anderson's concerns. And so I'm going to support the bill on the basis that that's what we will do. So.
Yeah, and I have a question for Joanne right now. Joanne, are there other places in statute that doesn't matter what we do right here and how we word this right here, are there other places in statute that this is all happening already and it's in place and there's nothing we can do about it so that it will ease some concerns?
Madam Chair, yes, and I don't have the exact citation. Stacy would probably have that easier than I, but it there is already statute that indicates that if a parent is abusing a substance, alcohol or an illegal substance, if that abuse interferes with the proper care of their children or their child, that is a reason for a call to OCS. So that's,
And so I wasn't negating what you said. I was just trying to ease Tom's concerns here because we aren't changing any laws that are in place right now. So
just final.
Okay.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just to wrap up, and I'll just make an editorial that I'm agreeing more and more with Representative Sisna and the mindset. And just super quick, in judiciary, we've dealt with bills, and you've been involved helping tighten Representative Gatto, I point out when I see you, on DUIs. And we dealt in judiciary yesterday with DUIs and then with child and sexual abuse. And the bills seem to be more and more tougher penalties. Hey, we'll put you in jail if you have a higher BAC level instead of 2 4 years. How about 6? And if you sexual assault, how about this? How about that? And it's like, that's great, other than once they get out of prison or once they are done with their term of the drinking and driving, they're going to drink and drive again, or they're going to abuse again often. And it's like, boy, I wish we could put some money into prevention rather than just hang them high mentality, because once they're out, they'll do it again. So that's my editorial.
You know,
thanks
you
for
know,
tuning in.
Yeah, and we're on an amendment right now, and I'd like us to to deal with the amendment, and then, you know, if we want to editorialize after, that's fine,
one.
But let's stick to the amendment right now. So do we have any other comments about the amendment?
Whose okay. amendment is it?
It's Representative Gardner's amendment.
She did put her name on it.
And
she did?
Not on all copies.
Okay. It's actually Representative Gardner's and my amendment.
Oh, look at that.
So because we worked with the department on this. Representative Gardner, you presented the uh-huh. amendment, and having heard no objection, the amendment moves. So that leaves us to the bill.
I'll move the bill if you want.
Okay, Representative okay. Anderson.
After all my dialogue, I'll move the bill. So I move House Bill 408 as amended with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Okay.
Perfectly done.
And hearing no objections, the bill moves. And now, Representative Sisna, you wanted to speak.
Madam Chair, I think basically what I had a concern about was, in fact, the prevention. And if you wanted me to talk about the language that I've put on people's desks to think about, maybe for a later meeting, is that?
You know, I don't know. We can think about it, and if you'd like to put it on the record, you're welcome to do so.
Thank you. And the actually the language that I would hope that we were looking for is, in fact, a program that we did have in place in the state that was an effective program. And since, in fact, our numbers in terms of children being born with various kinds of substance abuse exposure before birth, it's not going down yet, if I'm correct. I think that it's not going down yet. And as long as it's not going down, then we need to be proactive and doing something. What it would do, what the bill that I hope that we would create would do would be to when the report of of harm, or when we get the information from what we just passed, when the department or whatever gets it, that in fact that would be an automatic trigger, and that, and in this case, I believe that what used to work was a very effective thing, and that was public health nurses, who are seen by people, especially in rural Alaska, as being very much a part of their community and someone that they see a lot, would come out and automatically do the kind of healthy family training that's done, but would also do an assessment, that it would be just part of the visit. It would be a friendly process, one that would hopefully have that mindset of the public health nurse of really trying to help the parent be the best kind of parent they can be, but also keeping an eye out in case that child is in danger, so that really just really working to the safety principle for the child, but also trying to keep families healthy and strong.
Okay, thank you. And that is something that we really need to think about as a state, how we can do that. And of course, that most of those things take more money. And you and I both are on the subcommittee on HESS, and there are some prevention monies, and hopefully those prevention monies stay in the budget so that we can see some of those things happening. So anyway, thank you very much. And now we are ready for our presentation. And our presentation was with the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence. And we have Matt Felix, who is the executive director, and Jessica Paris, who is the program coordinator. And you will both be presenting. You can come up and sit with him now, Jessica, if you wish. Okay. So we'll just sit back and listen. We're very interested in this. And so explain to us what you have here.
Okay, Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you very much for asking us to come over today. And it warms my heart to hear so much talk about prevention, because that's basically our focus and our agency here. And we're the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence here in Juneau. We're part of a national organization with somewhere around 96 affiliates. We have a number of duties that we perform all around prevention of alcohol and drug abuse, safety, health promotion, and disease prevention. We've expanded in the last 5 years and do a lot. We're part of a state system that uses the public health model, which is sort of a three-legged stool of prevention, treatment, and environmental strategies. We're the prevention part, although we do promote a lot of the environmental strategies. We're not here to talk about those today, but about the prevention part. We were invited here last year and again this year, and we sure appreciate being invited. One of the reasons that we have existed in Juneau for so long, since 1965, is because of tremendous problem with alcohol abuse and alcoholism in our state. This chart's sort of a bellwether chart that shows a tremendous amount of problems that correlate with per capita consumption. Per capita consumption chart shows just how much more we drink than the national average in the state. You can see we consistently drink over a half a gallon of alcohol more than the national average, and this chart is on the average for everybody over the age of 14 in the state, and it is pure alcohol or absolute alcohol that everyone drinks in the state. So alcohol is the drug of choice in this state. It's a lot, you know, more exciting to talk about a lot of drugs, but in terms of child abuse, impact on the judicial system, impact on the welfare system, impact on our healthcare system, alcohol far exceeds in about every other way. Why is that? Some of the data that has been gathered over the years, you know, is that we simply drink more here. There's a number of reasons for that, but probably about a third of us drink, very heavy in the state, where it's a lot less than the national average. There's more of us that drink and less of us that are completely abstinent. interesting data that nationwide since prohibition had been repealed, about a third of the people in the United States simply don't drink at all, none, maybe one drink a year. In Alaska, that's down to around 25%. That's been a consistent figure as Gallup measures every 4 years. There are 50% of our population in the state are classified as heavy drinkers or addicted drinkers. And the Alaskan, and if you want to do it on an individual basis, the average Alaskan drinks about 526 drinks a year. And that's 1 ounce of alcohol, so that's one beer per ounce or one glass of wine or a mixed drink. I don't drink 526. I'm sure everybody in this room looking at them don't drink 526. But about 18% of our drinkers drink about 76% of all alcohol. But that's a lot of people. I mean, 18% of our population drink about 76% of our alcohol. And that's a tremendous amount of people drinking a lot of alcohol.
That means a lot of them are drinking a lot more than 526.
Exactly. Triple, probably, at least triple. So, and these are the people that are impacting our health systems and our judicial systems. Back to us, we were founded by a woman, the first woman in AA, our national organization. We focus on prevention. Her focus in those days in 1944 was to overcome the stigma of alcoholism and to set up a system where people got into treatment and recovery and not be treated in the criminal justice system or were stigmatized as someone who was morally inept or something. And we're supported by the Smithers Foundation. Here in Juneau, we have a number of city and state, and majority of our funding is federal funding. We're a big program here in Juneau. One time we had there were eight or nine NCADD chapters across the United States, one in Ketchikan and Wrangell, Kodiak, two in Anchorage and across the state. As our system evolved here in the state, more and more people got into treatment and less people got into or promoting prevention, and our chapters declined within the state. We still have two or three that focus strictly on prevention. We think prevention is where it's at. Health care today is so costly. For every dollar you can spend in prevention, you probably can prevent 5 or 10 in treatment. We operate the therapeutic court here in Juneau, the ASAP system here in Juneau, the misdemeanor alcohol-related intervention services, public education. We have a statewide media campaign, a statewide school system teacher training campaign that you're going to hear about today, tobacco cessation, teens against tobacco in the school system. We have a number of highway safety grants that that we promote seatbelt use for, both for tots as well as adults. We operate a driver training system over at our local high school with simulators, and we do both community and school-based prevention. So we're a rather large agency for the size of the state and population. The focus on schools is becoming more and more prominent throughout the prevention because we know that there is so much acceptability of heavy drinking in our state. Even if people don't drink, there's a tremendous amount of acceptability, and that although we have to do community prevention and target adults and try to reduce that per capita consumption on that chart you saw earlier, we are focusing a tremendous amount on the next generation. So we've focused on this because we want to lower that per capita consumption closer to the national average, and we know that a tremendous amount of our health problems and our prison population and all the things correlated with heavy use will drop if we can get that next generation to transition into less use. We know two things about kids, and one is that if we can, although we have a zero tolerance policy, and that is the basis of a lot of our curriculum that we put in to the school systems and that we teach teachers about, we also try to pick curriculums that postpone first use, because there are study and study now that shows that If we can postpone first use of especially a legal drug like alcohol, then we reduce tremendously the adult problems later on in life. So we have two focuses on the curriculums that we put in statewide across in the school systems, and that is we try to get the kids not to drink, and we try to get them to understand the consequences of that, the physical consequences especially of that. And we also try to get them to resist peer pressure to reduce that or up that age of first use. Because over time, in a macroeconomic point of view, over time, we will reduce that per capita consumption. Today, I want to bring up Jessica Paris, who works for us, who is the main person. Jessica's a teacher, certified teacher, who is in charge of the program that you requested that we present today, and it's called Protecting You, Protecting Me, which is a MAD developed program, and it has to do with delaying first use as well as safety among children. And we're putting this into the school systems across the state by training teachers. We also use a little different model by taking high school kids and training them on this curriculum and taking them into the elementary school kids to put it on. So, and that's very impressive with specific types of curriculum as well. So Jessica, I'll turn it over to you. I'm not sure mechanically how to do this, but I mean, yeah, there you go. You got to go to the next one, yeah. And I'll be here to answer questions for you when she.
Okay. Now, what grade is this getting? What grades?
This is for grades, first grade through fifth grade. I just want to begin by saying thank you, Chair Wilson and the rest of the HES committee, for allowing me to speak today. My name is Jessica Paris. As Matt said, I work for NCADD, and I'm going to be talking about Protecting You, Protecting Me. This was developed by Mothers Against Drunk Driving when they changed the mission to want to focus on, they added the component of wanting to prevent underage drinking to their initial mission, and we are able to try to spread this in Alaska with a grant from the Department of Transportation, Alaska Highway Safety Office.
While we're waiting for that to come up, I have a couple questions. Mm-hmm. How many schools across the state has this program been introduced into?
I'm sorry?
How many schools across the state have this?
PYPM.
Yeah, you know, how many schools have received this presentation?
This presentation?
Mm-hmm.
The presentation on the, who know about PYPM or of actually
going into the school with the kids?
The Juneau School District, we've presented to them, obviously, because they're here. The Fairbanks School District, the North Borough, I think is the name of it. They've had a huge training for all the counselors in their district, and Anchorage is sort of our next focus.
Is there any, I mean, I would think that in the populations where there's I don't know, but I think I think alcohol abuse is up in the native populations, and so I was wondering if those are the areas that you're going to zero in on, or
there's a
it's across all stratus, all, you know, I understand that. I mean, it's everywhere, no matter who you are, but I think in those populations it's higher than some populations are higher than others.
We don't have a plan to focus particularly on rural areas, but we have recently, there's a tool now for offering an online training, which is going to make it a lot easier and cheaper to provide training for people scattered throughout the state. So this isn't going to work without the tech guy. I need the password.
We've called them for help.
Oh, they're thanks. Thanks.
Good.
This program primarily trains teachers to use it. I was speaking earlier about a model of, there's actually three models you can use in the school system. One is to train teachers to use it and implement it. We have a tobacco model that we use where we take high school kids and hopefully athletes and well-known high school kids and kids that are respected in the high school, take them in to elementary schools. They present curriculum directly to the kids in the classroom. And then the third model is in some cases, the curriculum from themselves, actually our staff going in and taking the classroom over from the teacher in the middle school. For example, we have another program called Project Alert, developed by the Hotel Corporation, which is a prevention program, a critical age group, where we actually, it's more complex, so we actually go in with our staff and work with the kids over a period of 8 lessons, over a period of time and whatnot. So it depends on the curriculum and what suits it best. Probably to answer your question, you know, to get this particular one throughout the state, we don't have a staff to go out to all these schools. We don't have enough time to get to the high school kids in all these schools. Probably the teacher training model, like we did in Fairbanks, is what we're going to use to be able to get this. And it, like Jessica said, it has a safety component as well, not just drug and alcohol, but you know, don't ride on your snow machine with dad if you're drinking, don't ride in the car with your dad if you're drinking and whatnot. And so this one will probably be teacher training and throughout the state.
Well, I was a school nurse for 9.5 years, and I did a lot of alcohol and drug and alcohol prevention programs, but it was easier in the little grades to show maybe a Smokey Susie doll and how it affected the lungs. It was a little easier to show the effects with smoking than it was alcohol, and it was easier in some areas. Alcohol is a little harder to get across the dangers of it, so I was wondering how you did that.
That's wonderful. Go ahead, Jessica.
Well, maybe I should ask first. I can proceed without this if it's going to be, a half.
I could go ahead, and if we get it, we can kind of double back or something, but go right ahead because, we're...
Okay. Can I just start at the beginning?
Sure.
Okay, all right. There's two goals for this curriculum, and one is that elementary students learn the impact of alcohol on their brain, and the other is that elementary students learn how to protect themselves when they're in a situation of being forced to ride with a driver who is under the influence of alcohol. Those are the two main goals, which I think brings up the question, why are we teaching elementary students about these issues that might seem a little young to people? We begin in first grade and teach all the way up to fifth grade. I had a few stats for you. One was that in Juneau, when they surveyed 13-year-olds, 31% of them reported that they had ridden in a car with someone who had been drinking. And at a national level, in 2003, there were 209 children under 14 who were killed while riding in the car with the driver who had been drinking. So obviously, that's one issue we have. And the other question is, why are we teaching elementary students about underage drinking? Which again, to some people might seem young, but on the YRBS, we ask Alaska students a lot of questions about their alcohol and drug use, and 23% of them reported that they had their first drink of alcohol before age 13. And they didn't mean, a sip off of someone's beer, it was at least a full drink. If not more than that, was 23% of them reported that was before age 13, which is about seventh grade. And this is pretty consistent between Alaska and the nation, that about 10% in fifth grade, about 10% of kids will say, I've already had at least one full drink. But eighth grade, 40% will say, I've had at least one drink. And so we see that middle school, there's just this huge leap in use, that there's a great initiation period there. And as Matt was pointing out earlier, any year you can delay first use by, we see the gains in preventing alcoholism. So if we can just get them, even a kid who starts at 15 but didn't start at 14 is 15% less likely to develop alcoholism, and the kid who waits till 16 instead of 15 gets another 15% advantage. And so that's why any year you can grab, in delaying the use actually helps. I need to talk a little bit about the brain and alcohol, and I'm an English major, and so I can't do it without kind of gesticulating, and it'll be pretty low vocabulary. But my next question is, how is an adult's brain different from that of someone under 21? Because this is key to this curriculum. And advances in technology are telling us an awful lot about the brain right now. This area of knowledge is just exploding, and the scientists are talking about how we're going to be rewriting our textbooks and maybe rewriting our laws based on what new things, MRIs and that sort of technology, are going to be telling us about our brain. So, one thing, and I think this is maybe it's fairly common knowledge, we used to believe that the brain stopped developing, or it was finished with its development when you were born, that all that happened in the womb. And then, educators certainly saw that this development continued on through childhood years. We talk about these different stages of development, especially from like age 1 to 5. But in the last 10 years or so, scientists have begun to say, actually, the brain is developing all the way up past 21, maybe up to 24 years of age. It's actually in the process of development. And it's not that the brain is actually physically, getting so much larger. It's not that, we're learning new facts, because we obviously do that beyond age 21. It's more about that the wiring, the organization, the functioning of the brain is actually changing throughout that time. Now I really wish I had a visual, but, they also talk about our brains developing on a schedule, and so it's almost like it's preset that at a certain age I'm going to, like, maybe say abstract thinking is a skill that really kind of starts to kick in maybe in our late teens, that there's kind of a set time for that to occur. And when you, if you could see my visual, you could look at a picture of the brain's development. We'll see that the most intense time is obviously the prenatal period, and 40% of brain development happens in those 9 months, which is obviously very relevant to the bill you guys were just hearing. But over the next 21, 22, 23, 24 years, the other 60% of the brain development occurs. Obviously, it's not going to be as intense as that time, as that prenatal period, but it's still the majority of brain development happens actually after birth. And there's sort of some key times where there's even more intense development than others. And so 1 through 5 is a period of very high brain development. In particular, right around 2.5, which we might experience as the terrible twos in our kid. And another sort of intense time is right around maybe age 14 or 15. terrible teens, right? This other period where your child might suddenly become this alien and you don't really understand them, and it's because there's all this, their brain is changing so much. And in the past, we sort of thought maybe it was hormones for teenagers, but now scientists are saying actually that's probably much more about the brain actually changing during that time. Wow.
That's very interesting.
Yep.
I mean, here I wasn't a crazy mother after all. Those were the times that, you went, ah.
So that's in direct answer to your question about you show kids' lungs and what tobacco does to them, we can now show, and this curriculum shows, and the neat thing about this curriculum is we show, basically, we associate the brain with the alcohol and the damage of alcohol. So we do now, with the latest research, understand so much more about brain damage, critical periods of time.
Wow.
That this curriculum focuses on that, like tobacco and lungs, like you used to do as a school nurse.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that's the question this leads to. How does alcohol impact the brain of someone under 21? It's obviously why I'm talking about this issue. And a basic statement I can feel confident making is that the alcohol affects the developing brain differently than the adult brain. That if, at 36, if I sit here and have 3 beers, and you bring in an 18-year-old who's, my gender, my weight, we're very similar, we had both just ate lunch, and they have 3 beers, it's actually going to impact their brain differently than it will impact mine, and vice versa. And mostly it impacts them more negatively. But how much, that's kind of the million-dollar question right now. We get research articles about this practically weekly over at our office. Like, there's a lot of work being done on this, and they can't get 14-year-olds drunk to test, the impact of alcohol. That's kind of unethical. So they get rats drunk, and then they slice up their brain, or they take teenagers who have already reported that they drink, and non-drinkers, and then do MRIs of their brains to see the differences while they're completing simple tasks, or they've even, someone did a study with people who were in their early 20s, so, you know, people who are legal age to drink in their early 20s, and then people in their late 20s, and had them have a few drinks and then, you know, hooked up their brains and watched their brain try to accomplish these simple tasks and found differences. I think one test, this seems hard to believe, found a 25% difference between the ability of this 21 to 24-year-old to complete this task and the ability of this 25 to 29-year-old.
Wow.
Which, I mean, it's very surprising.
And kids find this stuff fascinating, especially when you've got a brain sitting there and you're pointing to the different parts.
Okay.
So I guess the most basic thing I'll say is just the reason is what we're seeing is that alcohol disrupts development, and the way the brain develops is the neurotransmitters start talking to one another, and alcohol gets in there and interferes. It might imitate a neurotransmitter, it might block a receptor site, it just kind of messes things up, and so the brain can't develop along its proper path. And I think we're used to sort of thinking, well, okay, you know, an 18-year-old goes out, parties, they get really drunk, and that night they wake up and they have, you know, the next day they have a headache and they're a little hungover. But, you know, they didn't drink and drive, they didn't get alcohol poisoning, they're safe now. But what this is showing us is that the brain damage that's happening is actually occurring once they're sober, that it's not what happens while they're drinking. It's actually the day after, as their brain is trying to kind of recover from this. It sort of overreacts to trying to respond to this alcohol messing things up, and then the next day it's kind of rebounding from that. And I guess I just point out this brain, because it's still developing, this is a brain they're going to be using the rest of their life. It's not just something that happened this night. This is something that can still be, is still impacting how they think and how they operate, you know, perhaps much later in their life. So I was talking earlier about those different periods of brain development, that there's sort of these key times in the, you know, around 2 years old, around in your mid-teens. Those peaks now also become these times of vulnerability, that when the brain is at its has its potential for greatest learning and greatest development, is also the time when it's got its greatest vulnerability for being damaged. So obviously the prenatal period, I think we all know that. And then in those first 5 years, a very key time. And then again in the mid-teens. But the development, I shouldn't kind of dismiss this, development is occurring over this whole 21-plus years. And so there's potential for damage throughout that whole time, and that vulnerability exists throughout that whole time with certain peak areas.
Heard many times that if somebody drinks, and especially a young person, that if they started drinking at age 13, that their maturity level just kind of stops. And then if they get to the point, maybe by the time they're 19 or something, they've kind of stopped drinking, and then they start at age 13, and then it progresses. Now, I've heard that, and I don't know how true that is.
I don't know that either. I was just asking someone that exact same question the other day. I said, I wonder if this is why people talk about this emotional arrest, this arrest in the emotional development. And I didn't know if that's more about, if that's more in the area of psychology, or if that is has to do with sort of these structural changes to the brain. But I kind of was wondering about the same connection there, but I can't answer that.
If you ever find it out, let me know.
Okay. Again, I think we all want to know how much is too much. Sort of, again, I think the questions that keep coming up with FAS, and at this point, no one really knows, you know, what quantity, what frequency is going to cause what type of damage. Is this actually permanent brain damage? How long-term is it? Those are questions that I think are still out there, and no one feels comfortable giving a definitive answer. And much like with FAS, there's still a lot of dispute about that. And so also like FAS, a lot of people just say, well, there's no known safe amount, so we should be saying zero tolerance, which is in line with obviously our legal system and other issues as well. A question about that. Oh, but something that might be surprising too is that I've seen this in several articles where they talk about we shouldn't be dismissive of one severe bout of drinking, or someone who, you know, only occasionally drinks an awful lot, that the binge drinking seems to be the thing that's coming up as sort of being the most harmful thing, as opposed to perhaps someone who's, I can't say this specifically for a teenager, but in adults, you know, maybe someone who's having one or two drinks a day, that that is much less likely to be damaging as someone who goes out and drinks, you know, and severely one night a week.
Representative Gardner? Which is more how teenagers drink. You know, they tend to drink to excess, drink to get drunk, and they don't do it every day, but on the weekends, or college kids do it when they party. So
I think that is true.
It's very frightening.
So some of the predicted consequences of teen binge drinking are problems with addiction, problems with memory, it definitely affects the hippocampus area, problems with learning, problems with decision-making, judgment, and impulse control in the prefrontal cortex. That's an area that's got a lot of development those last few teen years when, yes, binge drinking seems to be at one of its highest points. So those are some of the key areas that we think are at risk from drinking. So that was an awful lot of talk to get us to the curriculum, Protecting You, Protecting Me, which I don't have that much to say about. But it's based on this research. That's where this, with why this was developed, where it came from. The some of the researchers who are working on these issues, you know, have looked over the materials, been consulted upon this. And there's many alcohol underage drinking prevention curriculum out there. But I think this is unique in that it really has this focus on how does alcohol impact the brain. Maybe a little bit like your question, Chair Wilson, about, you know, cigarettes, it seems so much more tangible. Mm-hmm. I think this is one of the helpful things about this is it really focuses on this very kind of more tangible area and really stresses how, in a lot of curriculums, why you tell kids they shouldn't drink is the same thing. I mean, it's true for adults, too. We say, well, if you drink too much, you could get alcohol poisoning. Well, that's true for my father. Well, if you drink and then drive, you know, you could get in a car. Well, that's true for my father. And I think it can be very confusing for elementary kids that you're telling me I shouldn't drink, but I know my parents do. And so I think that this curriculum, one of the great things about it is really kind of gets rid of that hypocrisy of we're saying, well, it's different. When your mother has two beers with dinner, that's actually very different than if you were to do the same thing. And it explains why that's very different. So I think that's a strong point of this curriculum as well. The PYPM was tested in over 3,500 schools over a five-year period, and it has been named a model program by SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. It's one of 66 programs, I think it's 66 unless they've added a few, that have received that designation. And it's also an OJJDP, Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention model program. It is classroom-based. I think as Matt was pointing out, that it's delivered within elementary schools. And it requires that the instructor be trained specifically by the developers of the program. It targets students in grades 1 through 5, as you were asking earlier, and there's 8 lessons per grade. So there's a total of 40 lessons. And maybe I should pull this up here. So this is... this is what grade? This is grade 5. There's an awful lot of information in there, and the lessons are very, very detailed. And so, you know, a teacher who doesn't feel very comfortable will get a lot of guidance. Someone else who's just, you know, very comfortable and doesn't want to read a lot of this can glean the information very quickly. There's in the younger grades, there's like, you know, big picture books, which is more appropriate for children. And then some of the brain science up, you know, around the fifth grade, they have a video to explain it as it gets a little bit more complicated with animation and teens getting MRIs and that sort of thing. There's also a version of the curriculum that's culturally relevant for Alaska Natives. They developed a special one for Native Americans and Alaska Natives, probably a little bit stronger focus for, I mean, just kind of looking at some of the symbolism in the text, I would say it's got a stronger maybe Native American presence than Alaska Native. But and as it's probably clear by now, it emphasizes the dangers of underage alcohol use, and it also teaches vehicle safety skills. So what does a child do when they're being asked to ride with someone who's been drinking, and what to do if they have no other choice but to ride in the car? What would be their safest way of doing that? It meets standards in many content areas, science from, you know, all of the brain and nervous system information, but health and language arts, and there's even some math in there, art. And and I think Matt has already addressed this, but it can be implemented in several different ways. A classroom teacher can be trained and then teach it to her students. Or what we think has worked really well in Juneau is that in Juneau, the school districts is lucky enough that they have a counselor in each school. And so the counselor in the school is trained, and then every class that she goes into once a week, she can teach this to her students. And so in that manner, every student in that elementary school will receive the full 8 weeks that's appropriate to their grade level. Another way of implementing it is to have community prevention specialists, and so maybe a local nonprofit prevention agency can write a grant for a prevention specialist and use this curriculum and go into the classrooms, work with the school districts and go into the classrooms and teach it as an outsider. And again, I think Matt was already talking about this, but it can also be taught by high school students. And they really kind of need to be in a class, like a peer leadership class, and the teacher becomes trained in how specifically how to work with high school kids. And then they go into the elementary schools and teach the curriculum. And they're found to be as effective as teachers or prevention specialists, and in some cases more effective. And they obviously have a lot of star power for these elementary kids. They just love having high school kids come in and pay attention to them. And so they really kind of have that maybe the rest of us wouldn't have, that drawing power. I have some graphs that evaluate the program, which I think I'm probably not going to be able to communicate these verbally. I guess I can just say they did, you know, in testing this, they had control groups of kids who didn't receive PYPM and compared them with kids who did. And the kids who received PYPM, and this was over the five-year period, they found that they had greatly increased knowledge of brain development and vehicle safety skills. Their attitudes about underage drinking also, you know, improved in the way that we would want them to. But that's probably a fairly slight amount. That's actually, elementary students tend to have a fairly negative perception of underage drinking, and so actually making it more negative is a challenge.
Until they get to middle school
and then it drops up. So a lot of what this is trying to do is not necessarily change their attitude, but build everything else to sustain that attitude through middle school and high school. And they also improve things like stress management skills, decision-making skills, because this curriculum has a lot of, teaches a lot of things like how to say no but keep your friends, how to make decisions, how do laws protect us. There's a media awareness lesson, and so they're learning a lot of the skills that are going to be necessary to to say no, that it's not as simple as mm-hmm. we had hoped in the 80s.
Representative Gardner?
I have some questions about those studies. And I'm sorry we can't see your charts. You talk about showing a great increase in knowledge of brain development and safety, personal safety issues and things. But what the program's really about is reducing teenage drinking. And what do the studies show about that?
So I told you I'd be asked this. So this was developed in 1998.
Mm-hmm.
There wouldn't be time yet to actually see how did the first kids... I mean, what are they doing now? How old are they at this point?
That's my next question.
Right. So at this point, it's impossible at this point to track how the kids received it, how they're actually behaving at 18 years of age.
Uh-huh.
And I think this is true in general, almost of every prevention curriculum. Like, how in the end can you measure that this kid behaved this way, this kid behaved this way, and it was because of this unit they had here. Matt can probably talk to this a little bit better than I can. But the other thing I was going to say is that SAMHSA is naming it a model program. And so based on everything they know about what's going to make a program effective, this has met that criteria for doing that. That in light of not, as an alternative to the fact that we can't track these things very easily, our next best thing is to say, does it meet all the things that we know, all the practices that we know do work, and this meets that criteria. And here's one other thing I could answer with. The high school students who teach PYPM, they also evaluated their use before they began teaching PYPM and after. And they compared it with other kids who were in a peer leadership class who had self-selected to be peer leaders, who are probably people who are already saying, yeah, I want to prevent underage drinking use, but didn't teach PYPM. And their rates of alcohol use and binge drinking and riding with drunk drivers and drunk driving, all of those decreased significantly over their peers, over their teenage peers, who hadn't taught this curriculum.
Madam Chair, in response, so what we really can say is that the evidence we have shows that the teenagers who teach this program, their drinking behavior may be affected, but we don't really yet know if the children who receive this program in elementary school, if their drinking behavior is changed in the teen years. So it would seem to me that this organization that's called it a model program may have jumped the gun slightly because we still don't really know if it's effective.
But what we do know, Representative Gardner, through the chair, is that these type of curriculums, mm-hmm. Jessica said there's a number of them, we just have to select this one, does delay onset of first use, and okay. That's critically important in terms of later life use, mm-hmm. how much they use and whether there's addiction developed later in life. Mm-hmm. So that's almost as important as not using during the teen years. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you.
I told Matt ahead, I know they're going to ask me this, and I'm just going to say, well, if you gave us the money to do a 20-year study, we'll do it. 20-year longitudinal study, we'll do it here in Alaska.
I think one of the things, you know, I don't look at that question in a negative way, but one of the worst things we can do is do nothing and let kids get into that middle school years without knowledge of the potential damage, without knowledge of the consequences of early use and whatnot. I mean, just giving them that knowledge doesn't mean that they won't use or that they're going to be completely absent the rest of their life. But it's almost, terrible of us not to prepare the kids for that period. We know they're going to drink. I mean, even the best kids get into those eighth grade area, first year high school, and the pressure is so overwhelming, especially with the alcohol that's so available like our state. And it's there all the time, whether it's in the refrigerator or whether it's with their peers or whatnot. To not prepare those kids for this peer pressure, to not prepare those kids to resist that that use among their immediate peer group, is almost, as a professional, almost abhorrent. We need to, just like you prepare somebody for cancer. I mean, if you're going to smoke, this is your odds. I mean, you may choose. But at least you have the knowledge now, and what you do in terms of macro terms will get much more behavior change out of it. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying?
Follow up, Representative.
Thank you. Well, clearly the policy of doing nothing hasn't been serving us very well.
Exactly.
But I would submit that there are a lot of things that we can do, including funding schools to such a level that any child who wants to play sports can. When kids have something else to be doing, then they're not idle, and if they care about playing in sports, for example, then they know they can't drink because they can't perform well, they don't make the team. It gives them an alternative, and there are a lot of such things that we give kids an alternative, something better to do, and then they won't be drinking. And we know those things do work.
And research has shown that
right.
It's important.
So that brings me to a question. What does this program cost to put it in a school?
So we have a grant right now from the Department of Transportation and Alaska Highway Safety Office, and it's pretty small, but it's allowing us to train people around the state. And it costs around between $400 and $600 to train someone in PYPM. I guess it could be as little as 200, depending if they were just trying to get trained for one grade. But for, let's say, well, I've been talking to a counselor out in Sandpoint, and he has an internet connection, and there's an online training version, and it takes 3 hours. And so he goes to all classrooms there, first through fifth grade, and he can do this online training, receive all the curriculum materials, and then teach this to that entire elementary school for, that would be $400.
Just for clarification, $400 would be 3 hours of training time,
and the curriculum to use for five grades would be $400. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You know, I think that kids nowadays, too, when I was growing up, I lived in a farm, and so there was always plenty to do, you know, there. And so I actually, the whole time I was in high school, no one ever even offered me a beer, never once. Mm-hmm. And so I can't imagine, it's just like, whoa, I can't imagine what it's like for kids nowadays. My parents didn't have it in the house. I think my dad might have had a bottle of liquor. That same bottle of liquor sat in that one corner of that cupboard and never changed, never, you know. And so for me, it's a huge, I know I can't even comprehend what it's like for a lot of kids now, because they see their parents drinking, and sometimes to excess, and they have to ride with people sometimes, you know, and maybe not their parents, maybe somebody else, but or in school. I imagine it's really a peer pressure thing nowadays.
You didn't grow up in Alaska.
No, I didn't.
You know, the prevalence here is, like I said, one of the highest in the United States, and the availability is a big factor, and the acceptability by adults of heavy drinking as models for children is one of the unfortunate things about our state.
So you're saying that it's so acceptable that nobody even thinks anything of it if adults drink, and a lot of them drive, and then you're saying that even it's acceptable to give it to kids sometimes? I mean,
well, we do, Jessica might address this, but the rite of passage, and the kid reaches 16, and parents providing alcohol and drinking with the kid is fairly acceptable up here. Yeah. It's legal up here to serve children under 21 in your own home if you're their parent. It's somewhat unusual compared to, other states.
So do other what is that law like in other states? So most states have a law that doesn't matter whether you're the parent or not, and kids can't drink until a certain age.
Most states. 21.
Do you know what percentage?
Boy, I don't. I used to know, but I simply don't. But certainly the majority of states.
Okay.
It's 21. Period.
Representative Gardner.
You know, that's an interesting point, because I always thought that part of the attraction of drinking for kids was that it was illegal, it was against the law, they were getting away with something, they were sneaking around, and that was sort of the fun of it. And I went to high school in England, and even though you were supposed to be, I don't remember, 16, 18 to drink, the culture was very different. And if you went into a bar as a teenager, into a pub, and they said, are you of age? And you said yes. They didn't have to check ID. There was no problem. As long as you didn't create a problem, they would serve you, and they were covered under their laws. But when I was in high school, we'd go to pubs for lunch from school and not drink usually. They had good food. And I don't remember drinking being an issue among the people I went to school with. And I think it's because the taboo was gone. And there may have been people that drank sometimes, I'm sure there were, but nobody went out in groups to get drunk. It just didn't happen, and it wasn't the goal of anything. But my own kids now, who are in college in different places around the country and high school here, their experience is that if people go out and they're going to be drinking, then they're going to be drinking. That's what they're doing. They're going out drinking, and it's appalling, and they know lots of people who will not make it home at all. Now, what the kids do, and this may, I think, is fairly typical, is they always have a designated driver. And I'm not saying that my kids do that. That's what they report that lots of people do. And at age 21 for birthday parties, in colleges across this nation, they do the 21 shots. That's the celebration. And if kids, and what they actually start doing in fraternities is several weeks before the birthday, they start drinking a growing amount each day, so the 21 shots won't kill them.
Hmm. Well, all I can, the research has shown that the taboo effect is simply doesn't promote drinking. I mean, availability is a bigger factor. If it was legal for 18-year-olds to go into bars and drink, there would be a lot more 18-year-olds suffering damage.
I don't know.
We we actually, because of this, a lot of the brain research now, and we're becoming even more, you know, cautious about anybody under 21 drinking. Certainly, you know, we've dropped the rate of teen fatalities in traffic by, 38% since we raised the age to 21, and we saved thousands of teen lives by doing that. So overall, on macro terms, you know, it's probably a great, great benefit to have set that age limit there.
Was it WHO, the World Health Organization, in conjunction with someone I can't remember? They just did a study about a year ago of European students, 16-year-olds, and I think partly to kind of look at that in countries where there is no age limit for alcohol, or where it's so much more a part of the family, it's just more accepted, or just the legal drinking age is maybe 18 or 16, how does that compare to U.S. rates of binge drinking? And so among 16-year-olds, they found that England, you know, had much, much higher rates of binge drinking. In Germany, that those two countries were much higher than the United States. But even places like Italy and France, where, I mean, it doesn't really match people's, you know, our I don't know, maybe our stereotypes or of what these cultures are like.
Well, I wonder, Annette, do you have any info? Sorry, Madam Chair, through the chair. If there's any documentation, has this changed over the past few decades? I mean, I have to think that the drinking culture for my parents as teenagers was more the way that Chair Wilson has described for her own experience. And I think that my children's experience clearly is very different from my own. So what's happened in the U.S. over the past 30 years?
Well, you know, there's cultural, religious, and actually geographic factors. You know, if I can use myself as an example, I grew up in a Portuguese family in the wine country of California, and we had wine on the table every day at lunch and at dinner, we simply just didn't drink it because it was somewhat innocuous. But if I did drink it, my father watched me. And I drank it very carefully. And if I had two glasses, I mean, he had big bushy eyebrows like I have, and his eyebrow would go up, you know. And if I even reached for a third, there was consequences. Yeah. And so there's a lot of cultural things that go on in these countries that are self-regulating to a large degree. But Jessica's correct in terms of data. They have, you know, when you start drinking earlier, we're now, you know, on focusing on the brain, but there's a tremendous amount more cirrhosis. And in general terms, there is a lot later on a life addiction. And it probably is because of the toxic effect, breaking down the different organs in the body, making people more susceptible later on. Mm-hmm. You know, overall, you know, and all of those factors, cultural, religious, geographic, and age and the first onset and all those kind of things, we know unequivocally that it's much better to delay that onset of drinking with this particular drug because of its toxic effects, because of the type of drug it is, the present type of drug.
It's really
more than you ever wanted to know.
Well, you know, it's really a shame because, you know, if probably 30 years ago, we know now, we would never allowed alcohol to even be legal. But because, you know, there's no way to change it back now because it's an accepted thing. Would that make a difference?
Madam Chair, we tried that. It was called
Gardner.
Thank you. We tried that. It was called Prohibition, and it was the start of the mafia and all kinds of things. We can't stop people from drinking, not adults in this country, for whatever reason.
Okay. Yeah, historically, this particular chemical has been with us for so long, since the 1400s, and it's accepted now. And yes, you're right, prohibition was not a failure in the sense of health care. I mean, if you look at some of the data, it certainly did all the negative things that you said, but there was a reason the prohibition, we amended our Constitution, not once, but twice. I mean, our Constitution's only been amended, 25 times in the history of this country, and two of those had to do with alcohol. One was to disallow it, the other was to repeal it. But if you look during that 10-year period of prohibition, we had a 22% decline in public health, residential asylum and institutional beds occupancy. It was a tremendous problem, and When it gets to extremes, people responded through their legislators and through the politics. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a reason. It wasn't a bunch of Kerry nations who amended our Constitution, and Congress doesn't amend our Constitution lightly. It was a nation tired of the chaos that that kind of drinking, unregulated drinking, to a large degree, created in this country. A no treatment response, destroying families, destroying, you know, affecting the workforce, and those kind of major things that created prohibition. Not a good response, obviously, but a desperate response by Congress.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Thank you very much for coming. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for inviting us. Our office is right across the street. And if you ever want expert testimony, I have a lot of staff in different areas of this that are experts.
Do you have the PowerPoint at all to hand out for us?
Sure.
If you could let us have a copy of that for the committee, that'd be great.
Sure. No problem.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we will...
Please... fight for the governor or what the prevention implement.
Yes, you know,
you mentioned earlier.
Too long the state puts the money at this end after the fact, and we have got to do it at the front end. We've got to start doing prevention. We can't afford to wait until the damage is done, you know. So
expensive to
yes. So anyway, thank you very much
thank
for
you.
Coming.
Yes.
Okay, we'll adjourn this meeting.